former CIA employee George Tenet on Afghanistan.
You know, we went to Afghanistan. It's interesting. You know, we allowed a country to legitimize its leadership from tribal councils, and Karzai was selected. We had a bond conference. We brought all the stakeholders in the region together to figure out what we were going to do.
Apparently, what the CIA did about 8 years ago in Afghanistan was some hiring. We learned the Afghan president's brother, Ahmad Wali Karzai, is on the CIA payroll. If the drug lord thing doesn't work out in Kabul, at least one Karzai's got a plan B. The Karzai who came in from the cold. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. On this Wednesday, October 28th, I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Coming up, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has his work cut out from him, and his work has been made a little bit harder by his friend and his party, Joe Lieberman. We'll talk about that in a moment with Todd Zwillick. And the World Series starts this evening. If it'll stop raining at some point in the Yankees' brand new stadium, we're going to talk about that stadium and how it's kind of like the Mall of America.
But first, Peter Baker, White House correspondent for the New York Times. Lots to talk about this morning in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But first off, does the revelation in your newspaper that President Hamid Karzai's brother apparently works for the CIA, does this come as much of a surprise, do you think, inside the Beltway?
Well, I think it's going to help reshape the nature of the debate a little bit right now as the president's thinking about what to do in Afghanistan. One of the problems has been the question of whether we have a reliable partner in the government there, in part because of the corruption of the family around Karzai, the idea that we're actually that much more entwined with his family than people had known is going to raise a lot of interesting questions.
Interesting questions, and we'll get to those in just a moment. David Loin, BBC's developing world correspondent in London. Do you think people on the streets of Kabul are surprised by the revelation?
If it's true, it comes as no surprise to me, certainly. Look, John, I'm glad somebody in the region works for the CIA. For many years, the CIA didn't have any eyes on Afghanistan during the 1990s. America took its eye off the ball and reaping the consequences now.
Well, we'll put our eye back on it. Peter Baker, David Loin, lots to talk about. Stay with us now. Everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, the death toll is rising in Pakistan after a massive car bomb exploded in the country's northwest today. At least 86 people have been killed, more than 200 injured. The explosion coincides with a visit from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who condemned the bombing after arriving in Islamabad today. Meanwhile, in neighboring Afghanistan, the United Nations says six of its staff were killed when gunmen stormed a guest house in the capital, Kabul. The Associated Press says at least one of those killed in Kabul is an American.
President Obama signs a big defense spending bill today. The $680 billion measure includes a pay raise for U.S. troops. GMAC, the financial arm of General Motors, says it needs billions of dollars more in government bailout funds. The government has already injected $12.5 billion into the company and owns about a third of it. We're going to learn about durable goods orders from last month in the big economic indicator out this hour, and new home sales are out later in the morning. Wall Street mostly flat yesterday. The Dow opens today at 98.82. The S&P starts trading at 10.63, the NASDAQ at 21.16. Because the economy is changing, we're looking for your stories on how you're retraining and retooling yourself in this changing economic environment. What do you call the economy right now? Is it in transition? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. We begin, as we often do, in South Asia. Instability, violence in Afghanistan and Pakistan. First, listen here in Kabul. It's the sounds from a deadly attack early this morning in the Afghan capital. Militants fired automatic weapons and stormed a guest house used by UN staff in the heart of the Afghan capital. Six UN staff members, including one American, it's believed, were killed. Across the border in Pakistan, a bomb death toll and a market bombing in northwest has risen to at least 80 people. The attack took place in the city of Peshawar. The BBC's Kim Gaddis is traveling in Islamabad with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
The explosion in Peshawar and the violence in Kabul come as a violent reminder for Hillary Clinton, if any was needed, of the difficult task that she and the Obama administration are facing, both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. In the fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, Islamabad is a crucial ally, and the Secretary of State will press Pakistan to continue its offensive against the Taliban in the northwest of the country, in South Waziristan. But she'll have to choose her words carefully. Her visit comes amidst a surge of anti-American feelings here. The attack in Peshawar will be seen by many as retaliation by the militants against the army's offensive. Hillary Clinton is acutely aware of the sentiments here and has stressed again and again that she is coming to turn a new page in what she described as a scarred relationship.
That's the BBC's Kim Gaddis traveling in Islamabad with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. So let's review the bidding here. Milestones in Pakistan, the violence, that bombing in Peshawar, 80 people dead. The attack in Kabul we mentioned earlier at the top of the hour, the third major attack in the Afghan capital in the last few weeks. It follows a series of attacks across the country. October, speaking of milestones, suddenly becomes the deadliest month for American troops in Afghanistan since the war began in 2001. Multiple bomb attacks in southern Afghanistan yesterday killed 8 more American troops, bringing the total U.S. troop death toll to 55 in October, and the month is not even over yet. For more on all this, we spoke with Peter Baker, White House correspondent for our other partners, the New York Times. We're also joined by David Loin, the BBC's Developing World correspondent, formerly a Kabul correspondent. He's the author of In Afghanistan, 200 Years of British, Russian, and American Occupation. We asked David first how the people are feeling about the U.S. presence in the region right now.
Opinion polls still show support for the U.S. presence, but it is slipping. It's slipping, of course, because of the number of civilian casualties. It's not just U.S. Servicemen and women who are being killed. A lot of Afghan civilians are being killed in this war. And it's slipping because of the widespread incompetence and corruption of the Afghan government. The Karzai government hasn't delivered over the time that it's been there. When you go into Afghan villages, as I have done, and say, why do you support the Taliban again? And they have now a presence in about 80% of the rural part of Afghanistan, people say it's because the Karzai government are corrupt. They don't deliver justice. The Taliban do deliver justice. So it's a real game of perceptions in the villages. Yes, nationally, U.S. Presence there is still broadly supported, but it's still an alien force, and it's going to be a very hard game to win hearts and minds.
Peter Baker, David Loin describes that the villages are the Taliban stronghold in Afghanistan. You report today that the president may be focused on a new strategy aimed at protecting the population centers. Apparently, I'm just making a conclusion here, conceding the villages. Is that what this new strategy is beginning to look like?
Well, they would tell you no. They're not going to simply surrender the rural parts of the country, but the idea would be to concentrate American forces in the places where the most population are, which would be Kabul, Kandahar, even Mazar-e-Sharif in the north, Herat, Jalalabad. And instead of putting thousands of Marines in some of the more rural, remote areas, focusing instead on those areas with predator drones and occasional special forces strikes to avoid pockets of Taliban or al-Qaeda perhaps even building up. Now, this is meant to be a way of looking at what General McChrystal there wants to do without necessarily trying to apply what they call a counterinsurgency strategy to the entire country, the underlying theory being that the Taliban is an indigenous force there. It's very, very hard to simply eradicate. So instead of killing every single Taliban out there, the idea would be to simply contain it, isolate it, keep it from doing major damage to the government in Kabul, and buy time for you to train Afghan forces to eventually take over the fight.
There's a great quote in your article, McChrystal for the city, Biden for the country. Now, does that describe a debate going on in the administration right now?
Well, General McChrystal, the commander on the ground, and Vice President Biden have been seen as sort of the poles, the opposite poles of this debate. McChrystal wanting 40,000 more troops for his strategy, and Vice President Biden being a leading skeptic of that, saying, let's not increase the footprint here for the very reasons that we've talked about, don't want to look like Soviet occupiers, and because he thinks that the bigger priority for America ought to be in Pakistan, which is where al-Qaeda mostly is. And the Taliban is not a direct threat to United States security. Well, al-Qaeda is.
Okay, Peter Baker for the New York Times. David Loin, you've just heard Peter Baker describing this shift in strategy, holding of the cities, or apparently what's under consideration. Does that sound like a set of repeated mistakes based on the historical experience in the region, or something new?
It's certainly very similar to what the Russians were doing in the mid-1980s when they had a complete rethink of their strategy to try and what they were trying to do was to try and make the government look more human and to, in some ways, to give up parts of the countryside. But the real dilemma for U.S. forces now is if they put more troops in, then, yes, more Americans are going to die because if there are more troops on the ground, there are more targets, and there tends to be a higher death toll, as the British have seen since they have been in a large strength in Helmand province in the south since 2006. Many, many more British casualties on the ground. But if they don't put those troops in, then they concede very large parts of Afghanistan to the Taliban and ultimately to their friends in Al-Qaeda. Mm. So the big political problem, the big political question that Obama now has on his plate is, can we put enough troops in to actually make a difference to the insurgency, to have enough troops to actually dampen it down? And the McChrystal strategy sounds really clever, but actually you'd need several hundred thousand troops, and they certainly don't have that kind of force and that sort of support from the American people to go in and do that.
So, Peter Baker, if we concentrate the forces into these nine cities or so that you talked about in the New York Times article today, does that mean we're conceding the agriculture areas, that we're giving up on the protection of these agricultural fields?
Well, that's a focus of debate right now. Obviously, you look at Helmand province, for instance, which has been a stronghold of Taliban. We put a lot of Marines in there this year to work alongside the British and begin to try to take some of that back to make the villagers and residents there feel confident that they don't have to work with the Taliban, that can support central government. But there's a debate about that. If you're using, say, 20% of your NATO force for 3% of the population, is that the best use of force? That's the debate going
on. Right. All right. Let's talk for a moment about this allegation in the New York Times that Hamid Karzai's brother has been on the CIA payroll for years, possibly going back straight to 2001 at the beginning of the U.S. Occupation and presence in Afghanistan. Does this exacerbate the notion, David Loin, that he's corrupt or denies legitimacy to the Karzai family and thereby the Karzai presidency?
I don't think anyone in Afghanistan will be surprised by anything related to this. And actually, I think most Afghans will feel, well, President Karzai is a man who is very close to the Americans. And, why shouldn't this be something that a member of his family has done? I mean, you will know about the widespread allegations about members of his family being involved in the drugs trade. There are all sorts of things said about the Karzai family. The real problem with President Karzai is not that he's too allied or not with for other foreign governments, but as he's indecisive, he doesn't take sensible strategic decisions which people in the country can live mm-hmm. with. I have to say, on the ground, in security terms, Kabul has felt much safer in recent months when I've been there than in years before. But if the Taliban are now really going to take on foreign civilians, and that'll change the whole tone of the city. It'll change the whole tone of life, and potentially it could make things much more difficult for the Karzai government or any kind of city protection plan to work.
Lots to think about. David Loin, BBC Developing World Correspondent, author of In Afghanistan, 200 Years of British, Russian, and American Occupation. Let me throw one last theory at you, Peter Baker, very quickly. What about people in Washington wanting to pry Hamid Karzai away from Barack Obama by leaking these allegations about the CIA?
Well, I not only couldn't I talk about our sources, I don't even know our sources. So there'll be lots of speculation about what the story means, who's trying to advance an agenda, and what agenda is being advanced.
We'll get to the bottom of all of it. Excuse me, Peter Baker, White House correspondent for the New York Times, talking about the allegation that Hamid Karzai's brother is working for the CIA. There's a jobs program from the federal government.
Which is no surprise to the Afghan people. I love the comment that at least someone is working for the CIA in Afghanistan. At least, we have people on the ground.
Well, the economy is changing, and if you can't be employed at the CIA, there's probably someplace you'd love to be retrained and work. At 877-8-MY-TAKE, tell us your story of how you're retooling yourself in this economy. Are you changing for the good or not so good? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, all the news on healthcare in Washington and the stadium in the Bronx. Good or bad for the neighborhood?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Takeouts to go. Top stories we want you to stay on top of, and we're following them this week. We begin with Todd Zwillick down in Washington. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, John. Good morning.
Let me just cough here and then say, in the poker game of healthcare reform, all right, I figure it stands about this way. I meet your Olympia Snow and raise you a Joe Lieberman. Is that what's going on here? Explain.
Yeah, well, trying to put him on the table. I'm not sure what the ante actually is in this whole game. Like, what was on the table to begin with?
It's our health, and I'm losing mine.
I guess it was never actually clear. So, yeah, we've been talking about, John, we all know this, that Harry Reid has said he's going with the public option and has been looking for ways to round up his 60 votes to get the debate started or get the debate finished. You need 60 for these things in the Senate, and it was always about the moderate Democrats. So we're, you know, coalescing around people like Ben Nelson and Evan Bayh and Mary Landrieu and even Olympia Snowe. We've been talking about them. And yesterday afternoon around lunchtime, along comes Joe Lieberman, independent Democrat of Connecticut, and tosses a monkey wrench into the whole thing, tells a small group of reporters that he will vote to support a filibuster, a Republican filibuster, which is a sure thing, if the public option remains in the bill. I'm just opposed to it, and I will support the Republicans on a filibuster. Caught up with Lieberman shortly after he said this with the mic, and here is his justification. Listen to this.
If a government-created, government-run health insurance company is in the bill at the end, it will do all those things. It will increase taxpayer expenses, health insurance premium payer expenses, and increase the debt. And it's just not worth it.
It's his party, and he'll filibuster if he wants to, I guess, is the idea there.
Yeah, you know, Lieberman is not a Democrat anymore. He does caucus with them and does support them on most domestic issues, not foreign policy issues, but not on this one. This is a problem for Harry Reid. You know, yet another senator he has to get. Now, Lieberman says he will vote to get the debate started. He'll let Harry Reid get this vote onto the floor. But if after all of the several weeks of amendments, the public option is still in there, he will vote with the Republicans to not let the debate end.
And so Majority Leader Harry Reid is shaking in his boots, right?
Well, of course he's going to downplay this, you know, as we all came right at Reid yesterday and said, oh my God, Joe Lieberman's really messing this up for you, Mr. Leader, and he's downplaying it. So listen to Reid on this.
He will work with us when this gets on the floor, and I'm sure he'll have some interesting things to do in the way of amendments, but Joe Lieberman is the least of Harry Reid's problems.
Little acid tongue there.
Yeah. Well, he's good at downplaying this thing. Right. A couple of facts really quick that are interesting on this. First of all, the insurance industry in Connecticut, Joe Lieberman has tens of thousands of insurance company employees in his state. He says that's not what this is about. This is about the deficit. And also, you know, remember, Lieberman left the Democratic Party in the first place because of the left hammering him over his support for George Bush on the Iraq War. He lost his primary
and had
to run as an independent. Yeah, well, if you think the left came at him hard on the Iraq War, wait for the blogs to come after him now, because he's trying to tank the public option.
Stay tuned.
Furious.
We will. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
And now we'll go to business with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. So, Louise, our friend Barmy Frank came out and announced this new plan that I guess is them learning from the Lehman Brothers mistake, right? They're going to be able in the future to be able to step in sooner for troubled banks.
Morning. Yes. You remember last year, Bernanke and Hank Paulson, two of the most powerful people in the world, telling us all, we don't have the power to take care of Lehman. It was actually, I remember many of us sort of chuckling, like, what do you mean you don't have the power? Yeah. You're the most powerful people in our economy.
Right.
But they said they didn't have the statutory authority. And that's what they're being given here. It's kind of a death panel for the banks. You know, we've talked about the death panel on healthcare.
They're taking when
the
removed life.
Right, do we pull the plug? But that is really my question. Do they pull the plug? When we have one of these big institutions that gets into trouble, now they'll have the power to go in and take them over. And this also does not prohibit them from using treasury money to help. Will they really unwind them? I don't know.
But the argument was that without this particular piece of this plan, the rest of the reforms in the banking industry don't work.
That's right. I mean, most people agree that some death panel power is needed. The question is, what do they do when they get in there? Do they unwind the companies or do they let them hobble along? You know, a lot of people are saying that some of the big banks right now with taxpayer money are just hobbling along. There's another one in the news, you know, GMAC.
Right. We just talked about that.
We were talking about that.
But they're getting another bailout.
GMAC is obviously the financial arm, the General Motors. But they're getting another bailout because, and what is the reasoning here? They're still in trouble. We already own a third of this company, do we not?
So
the taxpayers?
Yes, we own more than a third. GMAC provides auto loans that help people across the country buy cars. Also, GMAC is one of the most important dealer financing companies. Mm. That means they lend money to dealers to get the cars on their lots. Without GMAC, a lot of people feel that our auto industry would fall even further than it's already fallen.
Right. Thanks so much, Louise. Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
So another takeout now coming from you, the listeners. We spoke yesterday about green initiatives generating new jobs. Remember?
The number of green jobs has grown by about 9%, while jobs broadly have grown about 3%.
It's Bracken Hendricks, an architect of clean energy portions of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the so-called stimulus package. Well, a listener in Massachusetts took some issue with Mr. Hendricks.
The paradox is, if you're a really good green entrepreneur or green engineer, you want to make your green product affordable. That means using as little as possible labor and materials.
And at thetakeaway.org, there's a little bit of a gender war going on. It was sparked by our conversation with Lisa Belkin, our contributor. She talked earlier this week about children taking on household chores.
After all these years of telling boys and girls that they were the same, the boys are still mowing the lawn and the girls are still doing the dishes, by broad generalization.
And with that, Emasi writes some wisdom for us. So women tend to do more housework because they are more obsessive about neatness and cleanliness than guys tend to be. Exhibit A, the toilet seat. Women want it left down, so it must be left down. No negotiation, no compromise. This is how it must be, Amasi writes.
Oh, really, says Katya. She says not all women are more obsessive about cleaning. When it comes to making a dwelling acceptable, everyone should pitch in, regardless if they care that the dust bunnies have built a fortress in the bathroom or the dirty underwear that has accumulated on the floor for a week is making the bedroom stink. Keep that debate going at thetakeaway.org.
Are women clean or slobs? This is a good debate to have, I think. And the healthcare debate is on many of your minds. We're getting some of your ideas of how to actually fix things.
Hi, I'm Brandon from Oklahoma City. Best way to go with this public option, just force it on us. I'm sure that there wouldn't be any kind of major protest. Go ahead and force it on us. I'm sure we'll be happy with it in the long run.
He's trying to be a little sarcastic
I think we've heard from Brendan before. I like that, though.
Sending your suggestions on how to reform healthcare. Later this week, we're going to also be talking about the scariest movies ever, and we want to know, what do you think is the scariest movie ever? John?
Come and play with us, Danny. The Shining, that's one.
There you go.
Night of the Living Dead, Night of the Living Dead, Night of the Living Dead.
Coming up. It's New York versus Philly in the World Series. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. Keep the comments coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the Yankees versus the Phillies. Does that mean it's New York versus Philadelphia? Can't we all just get along? We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour. At least 86 people are dead after a bombing in a crowded market in northwestern Pakistan. The blast happened just hours after Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in the capital, Islamabad. She's condemned this morning's attack, calling it vicious and brutal. In neighboring Afghanistan, gunmen have attacked a United Nations guest house in the capital, Kabul. Six UN employees, including one American, have been killed. The Taliban has claimed responsibility.
Back at home, it could be bailout number three for GMAC, the financial arm of General Motors. A Treasury Department spokesman confirms the auto lender is in talks with the government for billions more in cash. The government has already injected $12.5 billion into the company and owns about a third of it. In California, residents are preparing for a commuter nightmare today. Both directions of the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge are closed after a cable snapped. The bridge will be closed for at least 24 hours. And finally, theaters around the world have begun screening a movie based on footage of Michael Jackson's final concert rehearsals. The film, This Is It, premiered in L.A. last night. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Coming up, news to anybody. The World Series begins tonight. The Philadelphia Phillies playing the New York Yankees in New York. The first two games are going to be played in that brand spanking new Yankee Stadium. It's a huge white structure. It opened this season in the Bronx and cost the public more than $850 million to build. And some of the claims when they were constructing it were that it was going to improve the neighborhood that surrounds it. Well, we're joined now by Ilsa Chang. She's a reporter for member station WNYC, New York Public Radio. And Ilsa's been reporting on what the new stadium has done for those living around it. So first, Ilsa, can you give us a picture of what the new stadium looks like?
Well, in one sense, it's this beautiful gleaming white structure. But when you walk in, you automatically feel like you're in this enclosed shopping center. I mean, the stadium itself has 4,000 less seats than the old stadium, but they've more than made up for that in how much you can shop at Yankee Stadium.
I mean, there's prices.
Exactly.
Prices for the seats.
There's something like 125 concession stands, 56 souvenir shops, a half a dozen high-end bars and restaurants. And what you see are big brand names like Nathan's Hot Dogs, Hard Rock Cafe, you know, Carvel Ice Cream. You do feel like you're in a mega mall.
Here's one Yankee fan outside the stadium.
You walk around and it's like you're, like you're not even in the game. You walk around like it's like you're in a mall. You have a whole bunch of stuff to do. You could buy food. You could buy like merchandise, whatever. It's like this takes you away from reality.
So he kind of sounds like he's a little bit excited about it. Some people like the feeling of being inside a gleaming mall.
Well, yeah, that was George Figueroa. He's a lifelong Bronx resident. And he basically said to us, you know, the Bronx doesn't have a mall like this. And this is kind of like our resort for the neighborhood. It makes us feel like we, you know, we're just as able to spend money like everyone else. So he actually liked his experience at the new stadium.
It's bringing people in. I mean, people definitely will go to the stadium. But was it worth $850 million, people are asking, to just get them into this one location and then they get into the subway or the train and go home? You were saying that there's mostly big chains inside. So clearly this is not... The people are not getting outside. Did you see people walking outside to surrounding?
You know, not a lot. And that's exactly what the businesses on 161st Street are saying, is that there's actually less foot traffic on that street right now. And they have a lot of reasons for that. They're saying there's this new Metro North station that's right by the stadium. It spits people out right away. There's, you know, parking garages that are closer to the stadium, so people aren't parking further down 161st Street anymore and walking up, going past the bars, past the restaurants. They're just going right into the stadium. And there's 4,000 less seats, so you multiply that over 82 home games. That's a lot less people wandering around the streets spending their money.
It's kind of like a Yankee Disneyland. You spoke with an economist who studies stadiums.
The bottom line is these are bad investments for everybody except the team. The team does very well, thank you. But for the community at large, they do not produce any return at all. And in particular, for the area around a sports facility, there usually is a significant negative effect of having a baseball stadium or a football stadium plunked down in the middle of their neighborhood.
A negative effect on the neighborhood around it?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of these businesses are reporting that they're still suffering losses. I mean, they're not doing as well as they have in previous baseball seasons. I mean, I'm hearing percentages like we're 60% down. They originally were 80% down. One souvenir shop called Jeans Plus was originally 80% down. They're creeping up to 60. Yankee Tavern, legendary bar, used to be frequented by Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle. They were 75% down on opening day. Now they're about 20% down. That was Roger Knoll at Stanford University, and he has studied every single stadium that has been built in the last 20 years with his colleague at Smith College, Andrew Zimbalist. And they have found that in every single situation, the local economy doesn't really get that much of a meaningful boost.
Thanks. Ilsa Chang is a reporter for member station WNYC, New York Public Radio.
Rocky on that first step, headed to the top one. Yeah, that's me. We go hard where I'm from.
All right, so there's no economic benefit from the deal of the Yankees versus the Phillies, but let's talk for a moment about the sports identity of these two cities, Philadelphia and New York. And as far as Philadelphia is concerned, Jay, in the control room, I do not want to hear the Rocky theme at all during this segment, please. Okay, can we count on that? Michael Zuckerman joins us, history professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
Just have a couple of minutes. You know, I'm thinking about sports identity of Philadelphia and New York, and I think Raging Bull in New York, sort of rough and raw, and you've got the rough and heroic Rocky in Philadelphia. But the rivalry and the identity between New York and Philadelphia goes back a long, long way. Explain.
Sure. The rivalry goes back to the 17th century and heats up in the 18th century when Philadelphia, which begins about 60 years later than New York, begins overtaking New York. And it's in a way not much of a rivalry at all in the 18th century. Philadelphia doesn't think of New York as a rival. Philadelphia overtakes New York. assumes New York is left in the dust. Ben Franklin's not worried about New York.
Right.
Ben Franklin is envisioning London as Philadelphia's rival. Franklin literally thinks that America is going to outstrip England in population. The capital of the empire will move its capital to Philadelphia. Parliament will meet in Philadelphia. The king will be in Philadelphia. And he's not worried about New York at all.
All right. Of course, things turned out a little differently than that.
Turned out a lot differently.
Yeah. And is Philadelphia over that at this point?
Well, it took a while to get over it. I just had a student do an honors thesis for me studying the early 19th century when New York first passes Philadelphia in population in the 1800 census and then continues to get further ahead. And for the first... When the first census came out, Philadelphians just didn't believe it. They couldn't conceive that New York could be bigger than they.
Ouch. Well, Michael, we're going to talk to you again as this World Series event happens. Thanks to Michael Zuckerman, history professor at the University of Pennsylvania. I hope, Jay, what did I tell you? No. Coming up, we talk about food every Wednesday. How can you hate okra if it's in a Bloody Mary? We're going to talk about okra, the veggie people love to hate, in a moment. But make it stop. Make it stop. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. For many colleges that have very, very active football programs, very often the presidents of those colleges say that the athletics make the academics possible, that it's a partnership that goes hand in hand. We're joined now by Britt Kerwin. He's chancellor of the University System of Maryland and co-chair of the Knight Commission, which is an intercollegiate athletics watchdog group. And Britt, we have a new commission study where they surveyed 95 presidents, and they're pointing to the athletics program as a problem at their institutions. Can you explain what the presidents had to say?
Right. Well, these are the presidents that are in the major football conferences. There are 120 what we call Division I-A football programs in the country, so they play big-time college football. And I think what we've seen over the last decade or so is a spiraling up in the expenditures on intercollegiate athletics. There's an arms race of sorts underway, everybody trying to build bigger stadiums and hire more coaches at astronomical salaries. Meanwhile, the economic circumstances of most of our universities have gone south, and so we have this incredible discrepancy between expenditures in intercollegiate athletics and what we're investing in our academic programs. Just to illustrate that, the expenditures in athletics over the last several years have been growing at about four times faster than expenditure on academics. And, you know, I just don't think that's a situation that can be allowed to continue.
85% of these presidents said the salaries for football and basketball coaches are too high. And they also said that, for the most part, these athletic programs aren't actually making them any money. Is that accurate?
That's true. I mean, that's something that... is not well understood by a lot of people in the general public. Of these 120 or so programs, 75% are losing money, and the average loss is $10 million a year. Now, when I say they're losing money, at the end of the year they got to balance their the budget. And so what happens is there is a transfer from other institutional resources to close that gap. And so at a time when classes are being cut and tuitions are rising and people are being furloughed, we're in a situation where universities are having to close that gap
subsidize
in their athletic
budgets, program.
Right?
But the other thing that's disheartening is that many of these presidents say they don't think they can solve the problem. They don't think they can fix it.
Well, I think that has to be interpreted in the right way. I think what presidents are saying, that by themselves they can't solve this problem. In other words, no president feels that he or she can afford to step up and say, you know what, we're going to really de-emphasize intercollegiate athletics. So it's not something where it can be done on a case-by-case basis. But what I think presidents do feel is that there can be some collective action. The NCAA could create policies and practices which would begin to bring these costs under control and start to move them in the other to lower them somewhat. So I think that's what we've got to look to, is collective action, not individual action.
I think that's a tough sell, too, Britt. Kerwin is the chancellor of the University System of Maryland, co-chair of the Knight Commission. It's an intercollegiate athletics watchdog group.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee. Coming up, are you a hater? Do you hate okra? Do you glare at it as you pass by in the fresh produce aisle? We're going to talk to you about how you can develop a loving relationship with okra as we talk about food in just a few minutes. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. An explosion in Peshawar, Pakistan this morning has killed at least 86 people. We spoke about the bombing with Mark Dummett, the BBC's correspondent in Islamabad, earlier this morning, and we asked him to fill us in on the details.
It was a huge explosion. It ripped through the crowds at a marketplace in Peshawar, which is the main city in northwest Pakistan, a city which has really been bearing the brunt of the militant attacks over the past year or so. Bodies have been pulled out from the wreckage of this blast, which brought down, you know, many of the shops in this old historic marketplace.
And is there any claim of responsibility? The earlier dispatches were saying Taliban suspected.
Yeah, no claim of responsibility yet, but the government, of course, does blame the Taliban militants. Other attacks, they do say that they are behind some attacks, but not all of them. But certainly this has the fingerprints of the militants all over it.
That was Mark Dummett, BBC Islamabad correspondent, speaking to us earlier this morning. Meanwhile, in neighboring Afghanistan, Taliban gunmen stormed a United Nations guest house in Kabul today, killing 6 UN employees. The Associated Press says at least one of the dead is an American. In his upcoming autobiography, tennis star Andre Agassi admits he lied to tennis authorities after failing a drug test. The book contains an admission that he took the drug crystal meth and that when he failed a subsequent test, he told the authorities he'd taken the drug by mistake.
Looking ahead to later today, Congress will hear testimony about whether concussions suffered by NFL players could lead to dementia. The NFL denies any link between the two, but Dr. Anne McKee, a neurologist who studied the brains of several former NFL players, disagrees. We spoke with her earlier on The Takeaway.
I've been looking at brains for 23 years, looking at brains from individuals from all walks of life, individuals of all ages, people up to 115. I've never seen these changes in brains except individuals that have suffered repetitive head trauma.
Neurologist Dr. Anne McKee speaking on The Takeaway earlier today. She's one of those giving testimony on the Hill today. World Series Game 1 tonight. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning. Oh, yeah, at about 11 minutes before the hour, it's time for a Bloody Mary, I'd say, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, I am drinking a Bloody Mary mix, virgin Bloody Mary, ladies and gentlemen, with a little piece of okra stuck in it. Okra, that's right. You're in the produce market, okay? Right? You're walking by the okra. You're walking towards the lettuce. You're walking by the okra. You're walking towards the scallions. Don't walk by the okra anymore. Jessica Harris is with us, food and cultural historian and author of the book Beyond Gumbo, Creole Fusion Food from the Atlantic Rim. Good morning. You have brought so many goodies into the studio here. I'm just all goosebumps. First of all, okra comes from Africa, so it's much broader than the Atlantic Rim here, right?
Well, actually it is, because the thing that's so funny about okra is it begins in Africa. It actually has its genesis in what geohistorians, geographers call that Abyssinian plateau,
right?
The sort of Ethiopia-Eritrea, yep. And it moves both east and south from there. So you see that you get this whole growth of the little green pod. I always like to say wherever okra points its little tip,
yeah,
Africa has passed.
Oh, that is so great.
That is cute.
You know, let me just look at the shape. Now, evoke in your mind, folks, the shape of the okra. It's a curious little seed pod, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, it looks like a plant, like other plants. But the great thing about okra is when you start to cook it and mess with it in the kitchen, it has such amazing properties. And, Jessica, I looked up in a chemistry text, all right? Uh-huh. Listen to this. The anti-adhesive qualities of okra, the mushiness, right, the yuckiness
Sly.
Of it. are assumed to be due to a combination of glycoproteins and highly acidic sugar compounds making up a complex three-dimensional structure that is fully developed only in the fresh juice of the fruit. This is one complex, heavy-duty piece of vegetable here.
Well, there it would be.
Yes, indeed. So why do you love and what is it about okra that makes it fun to cook with?
Well, I like it because of its, what I like to call, its mucilaginous properties, otherwise known as the slime.
There we go.
And I think that one of the things that we don't do, and one of the things that I love about it, is how we can use the slime, if you will.
Right.
I mean, so we can use it to bind sauces. It becomes a thickener. You can use it to...
And we've got some succotash here where that's
exactly
going on.
We've got a southern succotash where that's going on. Watch out for that habanero. We don't want to lose you.
Oh, you won't lose me.
Okay.
But I could go home early today.
Well,
that's
that could
a good
be
idea.
It.
You
that
got
could
me
be
thinking.
It.
You got me thinking.
Yeah, just a couple of bites ought to do that.
Mm.
And the idea is just okra, corn, and tomatoes. And when you put them together, it's like a perfect summer mixture. And the great thing about the southern succotash, the okra, corn, and tomatoes, is you can do it with the fresh vegetables in the summertime, but you can also do it with the canned or the put-up vegetables in the winter.
And these days, you can get okra pretty much everywhere.
Pretty much everywhere, right. And fair to middlingly year-round.
Right.
I mean, not always good in the winter, in the dead of winter, but... pretty much year-round.
See, you know, John, I grew up with a southern grandparents, two sets of grandparents from the South. I'm not afraid of okra's taste. Okra's delicious to me. Mm. I'm afraid of cooking it. I feel like I don't know how to cook
it.
Well, the thing about cooking it is it's simple. First of all, you can eat it raw. I mean, that's the thing most people forget is you can just eat it raw, snap it, get the very, very young ones, the sort of fresh little pods about the size of your little finger. And if they, you know, if you try them, if they let you at your market, you know, snap them. And if they're really crunchy, you're good to go.
Can I tell you, Celeste, my 11-year-old, the same age as your son, Zoe, is obsessed, loves. Her favorite snack food is pickled okra.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's this wonderful guy at the Green Market in New York City who makes something called smokra.
That's what's in the Bloody Mary here,
smoky
right?
okra. It's a pickled smoky okra, and that's what's in the Bloody Mary is the garnish.
Let's talk temperature for a moment. Is okra sensitive to high temperature, middle temperature, refrigeration, those kinds of things?
Well, not really. I would say it's pretty stable. It's pretty...
Because you can deep fry
the
okra.
You can deep fry it. You can steam it. You can blanch it, which I like to do. Just blanch it and then toss it with a vinaigrette as a salad. You can do all sorts of different things with it. So you've got a wide variety of cooking techniques that you can use. You've got all sorts of possibilities.
What kind of things could you substitute with okra?
Instead of okra?
Yeah, like if you were making, what kind of dishes in which can we pull out one vegetable and substitute okra?
I've
stumped her.
You have almost stumped me. Not quite. I would use it in some dishes instead of string beans.
Yeah.
I mean, I tend to do string beans, blanch them. And then saute them with minced garlic in butter. I could do that with okra. That would work pretty well. Okra, though, is so particular. It's a very delicate taste, which is strange, but it's because of its mucilaginous, its slime, it kind of takes over things. So you don't really want to substitute it. I wouldn't put it in coq au vin instead of the onions kind of thing.
There you go.
You'd end up with a coq au gumbo.
Right. What are the other qualities beyond cooking that are associated with okra? It has medicinal qualities. It has almost a mystical reputation in the places where it's been used in cooking for centuries.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about it is used in a lot of African religions in the New World context. So in Bahia and Candomblé, they use okra as offerings so that Shango or Babalu Omolu will all take dishes made with okra, and those recipes are amazing because we talk about the little bit of slime that we get if we steam or boil okra, but in those dishes they'll have a recipe that'll say something like, take 10 okra pods, cut each okra pod 10 times, cut each seed 10 times, and so you get this absolute sort of slide of okra that is almost like a cellulose curtain. But I think the other thing in terms of medicinal properties, as you mentioned, it's an emollient. It makes things slip. It makes things move. It has even been used, and this is, you know, do not follow what I say.
Right.
This is what I have read somewhere. It can be used for abortion.
Really?
In some cases.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that, actually.
Yeah, you probably have.
Yep.
If you read that chemical stuff, you've definitely read that.
Well, the chemical book said that it actually prevents bacteria from adhering to the inside of your body.
Well,
just
exactly.
One of the qualities. Well, Jessica Harris, this has been great. Thanks for the succotash. You can find a recipe on our website at thetakeaway.org for succotash blanched okra salad. And Jessica Harris is the food and cultural historian and author of the book Beyond Gumbo, Creole Fusion Food from the Atlantic Rim. Come back soon, won't you?
I'll try.
You can go to the website to see recipes. Mm. Yeah, it was delicious. Mm. And you can go to the website for just about anything. Comment on anything that you've heard on the show, especially the economy, your job. As the economy has been changing, has that forced you to change your job? Or is that maybe you're seeing it as an opportunity to change it to something else? Are you getting retrained? Are you changing because of the economy? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can't go to our website and buy a Ferrari.
You cannot do that. But, you know, you remember, John,
maybe.
How we talked earlier this week about men and women and housework?
Yes, I remember that.
Yep. Well, here's what one listener had to say.
Regarding the toilet seat up or down issue, as far as I'm concerned, it's 2009. I've been lifting it up and putting it down for 25, 30 years now. I'm just lifting it up. My job's done.
Well, there's nothing we won't embrace with the passion of our careers as journalists.
You be the one that embraces the toilet seat.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Nothing escapes us.
Protecting American jobs has been a rallying cry since Bill Clinton signed NAFTA into law.
This is not a rally about just saving jobs in America. This is a fight to save working men and women, whether you're in the United States, in Mexico, or wherever NAFTA raises its ugly head.
But if the jobs are in America, aren't they still American jobs? Foreign companies have owned businesses in the States since the days of the American Revolution. Maybe they're not so foreign.
It takes two, baby. It takes two, baby. Me and you.
It takes two. Our partners, our employers, our foreign investors. It's time to face our fear of the other on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Also on the program this morning, I'm here with Celeste Headlee. It's the Karzai family business, the brother of the Afghan president on the payroll of the CIA. Yankees-Phillies, it's a World Series pitching duel, and Jacko alive and kicking on the silver screen. On with the show. This is it. Celeste.
But first, joining us is Amy Lindsay, production team member in Toyota's body weld department. So, Amy, you were thrilled to move from the Estee Lauder makeup counter into the Toyota parts factory line. Tell me, what's the best part of working for Toyota for you?
I would say it's the pay, the benefits, and the people I work with.
And which uniform is better, Estee Lauder or Toyota?
Toyotas, because I don't have to wear heels.
Okay, Amy Lindsay, we're going to get more from you in a few minutes. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, the Associated Press is now reporting that 91 people are dead in Pakistan after a massive explosion in the country's northwest. More than 200 are injured. The blast coincides with a visit from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She condemned the bombing after arriving in Islamabad, Pakistan's capital, today. Meanwhile, in neighboring Afghanistan, the United Nations says six of its staff were killed when a gunman stormed a guest house in Kabul. The Associated Press says at least one of those killed is an American.
Staying in Afghanistan, our partner, the New York Times, is reporting this morning that the brother of Afghan President Hamid Karzai is on the CIA payroll and has been since the war there began. Ahmed Wali Karzai has denied receiving payments. We're going to talk about that this hour. And here in the U.S., there's fresh economic data out just this past hour. Orders to factories for big-ticket manufactured goods went up 1% last month. That's the biggest jump in the past year and a half. And the financial arm of General Motors, GMAC, says it needs billions of dollars more in government bailout funds. The government has injected $12.5 billion into the company already. The taxpayers already own more than a third of it. And the FAA has revoked the licenses of the two pilots who overshot their destination last week. That means they're grounded indefinitely. I almost said FFA. Which is Future Farmers of America. Wall Street was mostly...
Were you one of those?
I was not, but my sister was.
4-H.
Wall Street was mostly flat yesterday. The Dow is going to open at 98.82. The S&P starts trade at 10.63. And the NASDAQ kicks off at 21.16. Yes, I was in 4-H.
You were in 4-H.
I
was. Did
you
have a little calf?
I wasn't on the whole livestock end of it. I did more of the sewing and public speaking, which I know shocks you.
We like to share here on The Takeaway, and we'd like to hear your stories of how your job and profession are perhaps rapidly changing because of the economy. Tell us, are you retraining for the changing economy, and what do you call what's going on in the economy right now? Recession? Not? Upturn? Downtick? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. We're talking about jobs today. And yesterday, the Democrats pulled no punches.
150,000 people, approximately, have been hurt as a result of the intransigence of the Republicans this past 3 weeks.
That was Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada on the Senate floor yesterday. He was talking about a Democratic plan that would have saved 150,000 Americans from losing their unemployment benefits over the past 3 weeks if they'd acted on this proposal earlier. And we're joined now by Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
So this was a major hurdle, right, for the Democrats, a huge victory?
Yeah, well, Harry Reid's overstating it a bit, as majority leaders often do. This is an extension of unemployment insurance benefits. You know, when the economy went south, Congress extended UI benefits for people who lose their jobs. These are federal benefits. Those are going to expire. So the House and Senate has been at work to extend those even more. And they're still going to get that after this procedural vote yesterday. But they would have gotten a lot more if not for all the partisan bickering that's been going on around this. What a bipartisan group of senators was trying to do, in addition to these UI benefits, was extend the $8,000 first-time home buyer tax credit. That may expire now. There were tax breaks for small businesses to hire more workers and to save money during the holiday season, hopefully preserving jobs. Republicans wanted other amendments on things like ACORN and things like illegal immigration. They just couldn't reach an agreement. So all of that other stuff that would have been good for home buyers and workers and businesses has fallen by the wayside, and now you're left with just the extension of UI benefits. Somewhere between 14 and 20 weeks is where it's going to land, depending on what the House and Senate agree to. So they could have gotten a lot more, but they got just the unemployment insurance extension for people who've lost their jobs.
Well, I imagine for the people who are getting unemployment benefits, that's enough. That's Todd Zwillig, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. But we are talking about jobs a lot today, and obviously jobs is on the minds of a lot of Americans. But there's also an attitude among many Americans that if they're going to get a job, they don't want to see foreign companies coming up and buying American properties. There's a lot of talk about saving American jobs. And during the Cash for Clunkers, we saw a lot of people talking about buying American cars. We're joined now by Micheline Maynard, senior business reporter for The New York Times. And her new book is called The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream. It's in bookstores now. And we're rejoined by Amy Lindsay, production team member in Toyota's Body Welding. She joins us from the Toyota factory in Princeton, Indiana. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Celeste.
One of the things I found very interesting about your book, Mickey, is you started out by talking about this idea that foreign investment in the United States is not new. Foreign companies have owned property, they've owned factories, they've employed American workers as far back as the United States has been in existence, and even during the time when we were just the colonies.
That's right. I mean, if you go back, the original foreign investors were the Dutch and the English, right, who came over here to settle. And then, seriously, through the 1700s, through the 1800s, the railroads, the mines in Upper Michigan, banks in New York, many, many businesses were foreign investment. In fact, foreign investment helped save General Motors in 1920 after World War I, when it was having trouble getting back on its feet.
So this idea that we have to save American companies and American plants and these things that are American institutions that people feel so emotionally connected to, when did this passionate antipathy towards foreign companies, when did that begin to develop?
You know, it goes in waves. And around World War I, there was a really passionate feeling against the German companies. In World War II, against German and Japanese companies. In the 70s, especially against Japanese automakers, you know, against the Chinese as recently as just a couple of years ago in a big oil deal. So it pops up, and I think one of the reasons is fear. I think people see foreign invaders and they don't know that it can have positive ramifications for Americans.
Well, let's talk about one positive ramification, which is Amy working at a Toyota plant in Indiana. Amy, you went from the Estee Lauder makeup counter to working on the plant. And in fact, you didn't get the job at Toyota. This was a job that you very, very energetically sought, and it took you a little bit to get it, right?
It did. I went through the first process, and you actually went through 3 days of work where you were actually simulated to be on the line before you ever got to fill out an application.
They were trying to see if you would last doing the repetitive work.
Exactly.
And you did.
Well, I did, yes. My best friends thought I wouldn't last 2 months, and I've been here 7 years. So, so good.
I've been to a lot of these plants around the country, Nissan, Honda, and the workers are very, very happy. They love having these jobs. These are typically non-union shops, though, so it's a little different than the typical manufacturing in the United States. How much of your book tells the story of permanent changes going on in the economy that bring in foreign investors, that maybe push out other jobs, but that really tell the story of the changing economy that's not going to be like it was for your mom and dad?
At this point, I don't think it's a question of pushing out other jobs. Jobs have left. American companies have outsourced, and they're chasing lower labor rates. And what they're missing is the ingenuity and the hard work ethic of Americans.
They're missing Amy.
Well, they are. And, you know, Amy has a great story about her father who fought in World War II against the Japanese. Isn't that right?
That is correct. He was a disabled World War II veteran. And, you know, my concern was that I was going to go to work for a Japanese company. So I asked him if that bothered him at all. And he said, absolutely not. I am so proud of you and so proud of the fact that Toyota came down here offering people great paying jobs in this area that Ford and GM didn't come down and offer.
Mickey, explain to me, we do have so many American companies saying, look, in order to compete, we have to bring our labor costs down. That's why we're outsourcing. It's a necessity. If that is the case, why do foreign investors come in and purchase plants here and employ these supposedly overpaid American workers?
Well, first of all, if you're working in Europe, our labor costs are lower than Europe. So Mercedes-Benz, BMW, those companies, Volkswagen coming over here, these are lower labor costs for them. Second, the governors of these states, even Michigan, are offering incentives to these companies to come. They give them tax incentives, they build roads, they provide other things like that. So when they come, it's a deal that they couldn't get at home, and it's a deal that's too good to resist.
They sometimes hand them parcels of land and clear the way completely to let them to come in. And one thing that you point out in your book is that someone like Amy, although she's working in a non-union shop, is actually benefiting from the work the UAW is doing at the Big Three. She's benefiting from that. How does that work?
Well, that's very true. And what's happened in wage rates, for example, is people in Kentucky and Indiana are earning, you know, in the mid-20s range. Down in Texas, they're not getting that. But the UAW plants that are still paying full wages are paying about $28 an hour. So it's sort of like
balloon effect.
Exactly. And it sort of floats the boat a little bit. But in parts of the country where you don't have a sort of a UAW presence, then the wages tend to be lower
because they're not afraid
and there's also not any chance they're going to be organized.
You know, Mickey, in the old days, Henry Ford created the innovation of the assembly line that sort of defined manufacturing in the United States. Your book also tells the story of America has lost its leadership role as an innovator in the manufacturing process itself. We don't make good factories anymore.
We do make good factories, but we've been inspired by the things that we've seen from foreign manufacturers. Toyota is a great example of that. Boeing actually studied Toyota to learn how to build its airplanes more efficiently. But those innovations do come here. Toyota has brought its body welding system to the United States. And I've just fascinated about it. I've been in 95 factories, and I think it's amazing when you see these processes come from overseas to our shores.
Another interesting point that you make in your book is that they're actually building research and development facilities in the United States. And you talk about this as this kind of meeting of the minds that all of the American factories and research and development guys can kind of help each other and spur more inspiration because of the close competition and close collaborations.
Right. EADS, which is the owner of Airbus, the first thing they did, even before they bid on this tanker contract with the Pentagon, $35 billion contract to build refueling planes, they opened an engineering center in Mobile, Alabama. So there's 2,000 people there who are working for EADS, whether or not they get the big contract.
Amy, do you have a name for the robots that you work with?
My gosh, I don't, but they are fascinating.
Amy,
I love to get to watch them.
Let's end with you, Amy. What do you say for all the many unemployed people out there? Can you give them some reassurance and not to be afraid of foreign employers?
Oh, not at all. I mean, Toyota gives so much back to just even the local community, not only from the incomes we make going back into local stores, local businesses, but the volunteer opportunities that Toyota gives us as well. Right now we're doing things for the Salvation Army, our local United Way. So we give back in many, many ways.
And that's true about among the entire auto industry. They're actually quite generous workers. That's Amy Lindsay. She joined us from the Indiana Toyota plant in Princeton. She moved from the Estee Lauder makeup counter to the production. She actually drives around delivering parts on the factory floor, Amy Lindsay. And Mickey Maynard joins us. She's the senior business reporter for the New York Times. Her new book is called The Selling of the American Economy. Thanks so much.
Thank
both
you.
Of you.
Congrats. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Oh, yeah, some takeouts now on stories we think you ought to be on top of this week. We'll begin with the business correspondent Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
And we've heard this logic from you quite a lot. If we bailed out the banks, then we ought to be able to regulate the pay.
Right.
Perfect logic there of the compensation of the bank executives, right?
Right.
Well, Ken Feinberg, the pay czar, Obama's the fellow who actually comes up with the math to shrink the paychecks of some of these bankers, is going to be on Capitol Hill. What are they going to be testing him on?
Well, one of the interesting things, they released his testimony last night, is he's going to say that he does not want his powers expanded, that he thinks the federal government should not enter the business of micromanaging compensation at other banks, which is sort of interesting. You know, in Washington, people are always trying to grab more power, and he's saying, I've got enough to do with these seven. Don't give me more.
So he's saying, limit it to the seven.
Yep.
And don't, spread it out widely.
And the other thing he's saying, which struck me as a little hopeful, was he says that he thinks that other companies may just voluntarily look at what he's done as guidance. Yeah. And he says, I hope they'll look at this as a model. And, you know, on Wall Street, workers want to make as much as they can. And I kind of doubt that other banks are going to look at these reductions he's made in pay at Citigroup and Bank of America and emulate that if they don't have to.
Is there an argument to be made here? And I'm sort of derailing you a little bit, but don't be worried. that all banks benefit from the fact that the Fed is keeping interest rates low. So the spread on lending is huge. And Goldman, okay, maybe they don't get any Fed money, but they're benefiting from this policy.
Absolutely. All of the banks are benefiting from a vacuum in competition in the market. They're all benefiting also from the assumption that the government may back them if they get in trouble again. So we as taxpayers are implicitly helping even banks that have paid the money back. But one of the things that's very interesting, I went to see Ken Feinberg in his office a few days before he released his decisions, and I was talking with him about how much money is too much on Wall Street. You know, is there a too much? And he said he had determined that one trader at Citigroup, Andrew Hall, who had a $100 million contract, that was too much. He told me he had determined that was excessive risk. And I said, okay, Ken, $100 million, it's too much. Well, what about $80 million? Is $80 million too much? What about $50 million? And there he really demurred and said, I don't know on Wall Street how much is too much. I've never worked on Wall Street. Maybe they earn those millions. And to that I kind of said, well, should someone be thinking about how much is too much, you know?
Well, he's going to get an earful from Congress today,
that's
for sure. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, The New York Times.
Now let's go to Washington with our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Todd, Harry Reid has decided to put the public option in the Senate health reform bill, and that is having effects over in their neighboring body, right?
Yeah, that's right. When he decided to put that public option in there, a lot of House members said, oh, well, maybe this thing is a reality after all. They didn't want to have to vote for something. Many of the people in the House didn't want to have to vote for something that was a tough vote that they thought would never become law. And then they're sort of politically out on a limb. This is Anthony Weiner. He's from New York City. He's a Democrat, and he's on the whipping team. He's responsible for rounding up votes, and he's a strong supporter of the public option. So he's enthusiastic. Listen to this.
Reid was worth 15 votes.
you know, maybe more, just of the number of members who were reluctant to commit to something without knowing whether we were going to be running up the hill without any Senate support. So it definitely helped us.
Now, that's the public option, but there are a lot of other issues besides the public option that are going to be really, really important here, especially ones that Democrats care about. Now, for instance, abortion is back. There are as many as 40 Democrats in the House who support the public option. Many of them support health reform, but they are threatening to bring this bill down if the Speaker and the Majority Leader don't put specific language in there banning any use of federal funds or federal policy for abortion. Bart Stupak is a conservative Democrat from Michigan. He's the ringleader of this effort. He supports the health reform bill, but he's big on abortion, and he's got 40 members with him. Listen to Stupak yesterday.
They would like to roll the bill out this week. Okay, made that very clear right now. They like to roll it out this week. If you're going to roll it out this week, then I guess the only way you're going to resolve it then is give me an amendment on the floor, because it's not in the bill they're rolling out this week.
What he's saying there is he's demanding a vote on the floor on his amendment. They want to roll this bill out, and they're demanding an abortion vote, and they could bring the bill down over this. Now, I'm not saying health reform is going to fail over
just
abortion, but there's taxes, there's small business, abortion, all this stuff. It's a lot more than the public option that we're going to be watching
this week
and next.
What else gets inserted or removed from there? Todd Zwillick is the Takeaway's Washington correspondent.
All right, a takeout on sports now from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor, and a pitching duel on tap tonight in the opening game of the World Series, weather permitting, between CeCe Sabathia and Cliff Lee of the Phillies. These are former teammates in Cleveland, and they're facing each other.
So for what it's worth, Lee was 4-4 with a 5.02 ERA against the Yankees this year when he was with the Indians. So that's something to think about. And also CeCe Sabathia in the playoffs, he's 3-0 with a 1.19 ERA. Both of these guys have been lights out for their teams going into this round. We know all about the Phillies batters. We all know all about the Yankees batters. So this series could be a high-scoring series. What it's going to come down to most likely is the middle relief. The closers, Brad Lidge has been closing like he did last year, and Mariano Rivera.
Yeah.
So it really is going to come down to middle relief, and in that sense, the edge is with the Phillies.
But the battle in this first game is huge, and these guys are friends. These guys are close friends.
They were the last two Cy Young Award winners, so it's definitely a classic pitching duel up in the Bronx. And the next game is A.J. Burnett for the Yankees going against none other than Pedro Martinez, who's also been sort of a Yankee killer and a Yankee a nemesis of the Yankees for a long time.
And Pedro used to be a Met, right?
He was a Met.
Red Sox. I mean, but that reminds me. I mean, this series, a lot of the TV executives are saying that a lot of people aren't going to watch it because it's just all on the East Coast. But there's a group of people in New York where this, not only are they not going to watch it, this is torture.
This is a nightmare for Mets fans because they hate the Phillies and they hate the Yankees. I'm saying all the Mets fans out there, give some love to your hometown team.
That's a tough sell.
But on sports radio, they are arguing over whether they should root against the Yankees or root against. These are truly arguments that have gone for a long time.
If you root from the NL East perspective, if the Phillies win, then it looks better for their conference. From the perspective of a New York perspective, you know, they're a New York team. So obviously the New York team would win. And on that note, the mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter, and the mayor of Michael Bloomberg in New York City.
Your mayor, okay.
The guy. They placed a one-of-a-kind wager on the World Series. The losing mayor will have to travel to the winning city to join the winning mayor in a volunteer service project while wearing a jersey from the winning team.
Oh, all right. Humiliating.
Well, the good and the bad.
Indeed.
There.
The last thing is $15.5 million is generated from each game in New York City for the New York Yankees in each World Series.
All right,
game,
there's an economic benefit. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, talking about the World Series Game 1 tonight, weather permitting.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, Hamid Karzai's brother. He works for the CIA. Is it a main gig or is he moonlighting? We'll find out. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. In Pakistan, an attack in the northwest city of Peshawar has left at least 91 people dead. The bomb struck in a crowded marketplace while Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is visiting the country in the nation's capital, Islamabad, today. In neighboring Afghanistan, security officials are warning international organizations to be on alert after militants stormed a UN guest house in Kabul
leaving 12 dead, among them six UN workers.
Back at home, it could be bailout number three for GMAC, the financial arm of General Motors. A Treasury Department spokesman confirms the auto lender is in talks with the government for billions more cash. The government has already paid $12.5 million to shore up the company. We, the taxpayers, own more than a third of it. In sports, the Phillies play the New York Yankees in the Game 1 of the World Series tonight. That's some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Joining us now is Mark Mazzetti, New York Times national security correspondent, and one of the bylines on a story that the New York Times is reporting this morning, that the brother of Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, has been on the CIA payroll for years. The revelation comes as the Obama administration is attempting to adjust its strategy in Afghanistan. It also comes amidst renewed violence in Afghanistan and the revelation as of yesterday that this month is the bloodiest month in the war in Afghanistan, with 55 American servicemen dead, and October isn't even over yet. Mark Mazzetti, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So I'm doing a little history here. We don't know all the details, but I remember reports of George Tenet and the CIA running around Afghanistan in the early days after 9/11, literally handing out cash to warlords and individuals they were trying to befriend in Afghanistan. It sounds like, and I don't know if you've stumbled on this in your reporting, but it sounds like George Tenet came upon Hamid Karzai's brother pretty early in the game. How long has this been going on?
Well, from our reporting, we know that Akhmedwali Karzai has been working with the agency for quite some time. He does a number of things for the U.S. and has for years. Not only does he rent out compounds in Kandahar to use by American officials, both covert and overt, but he also helps the United States sort of as a liaison with the Taliban as the Obama administration tries to peel Taliban off from the main central part of the militia. And he also helps recruit in some militia organizations in the South that fight on counterterrorism missions.
And what about the issue of his connection with the drug trade inside of Afghanistan? Is the connection with the CIA something that allows the U.S. government to have leverage over his drug activities, or do they simply tolerate it and use him for other purposes?
Well, there's certainly a dispute about just how tied he is. There's certainly a large part of the U.S. government thinks that he's intimately tied and to the drug trade, which is the biggest industry in southern Afghanistan, and that he enriches himself from the drug trade. Those who are more sympathetic to him say, listen, there's no ironclad evidence. There's no single piece of intelligence that ties him to the drug trade. So, you know, in some cases, they might, the CIA and others in the intelligence community might say, okay, obviously, this might not be the most savory character. However, he's useful for us, and you know, anything criminal he might be doing could not be held up in a court of law.
You know, perhaps the timing of this story is the most curious thing about it. I'm wondering if the sources you talk to have some kind of axe to grind with either Walid Karzai or his brother Hamid Karzai, who's had difficulty with the Obama administration over issues of corruption and his management of the Afghan government.
Well, we talked to a lot of people sort of on all sides of this debate. There's definitely a debate in the Obama administration right now about whether, on one hand, you know, can the U.S. press Hamid Karzai to rid his government of corruption, and at the same time, another aspect of the U.S. government is paying his brother, who is believed by many to be one of the more corrupt individuals in Afghanistan, that any leverage that the U.S. has with Karzai is taken away because Karzai knows that his brother's on the payroll. So I think part of it is an effort maybe to get better leverage with Karzai. But, you know, and there's also a hope, I think, by some in the U.S. government to have the U.S. speak with a more unified voice. They say, okay, are drugs a priority or are they not? And if they are a priority, counter-narcotics, then you know, the United States government should not be so closely tied with people who many believe are enriching themselves from the drug trade. Again, keeping in mind this is Afghanistan, and many senior officials may have had some brushes with the drug trade in the past.
Now, does this hand the candidate who's going to face Hamid Karzai, we believe, in the runoff election coming up, a campaign issue to say, look, look at how much of a puppet Hamid Karzai is. His brother works for the CIA.
Well, I mean, I think that Hamid Karzai has had to face, you know, these issues for quite some time of being too close to the United States. You know, it is unclear exactly what the relationship with with the CIA and Hamid Karzai is in terms of payments or how the payments are made. You know, no doubt President Karzai will try to distance himself from this story. But I think that, yes, it might certainly become a campaign issue. And it's definitely an issue right now as the Obama right. administration tries to sort out its strategy for Afghanistan.
Well, finally, Mark, the CIA didn't speak to you on this story. Does that mean they're worried that you may have compromised one of their assets here, or are they just denying it all the way?
They basically refused to comment for the story. And so, you know, we don't read anything into that, and it's their right. So they just declined to provide any information for the piece.
But there seems to be a fairly broad consensus among former CIA officials, or at least the individuals that you talked to, that, yeah, this has been going on for a while.
Well, some people we talked to said yes. You know, Ahmed Wali Karzai was one of the key people that they dealt with in the past. As you said, you know, the CIA strategy early in the war was certainly to spread money among warlords to get them over to the U.S. side. Ahmed Wali Karzai was one of the more important key figures in the South. He's seen by many as the king of southern Afghanistan. And so he is a key person, an influential person, who the U.S. looked to get on their side. And so, you know, the people sometimes, you know, former CIA people laugh when they say, you know, who do you expect us to deal with? You know, none of these guys
right.
are Mother Teresa.
Right.
You know, if you want results, if you want to take on the Taliban, if you want to take on Al-Qaeda, sometimes you have to get in bed with people who, you know, you wouldn't want to admit to.
But, you know, what did we get out of the deal? I mean, I hate to put you in an analytical position. We just have a few seconds. I mean, it doesn't seem like we got much out of this deal for it going on for so long.
Well, it's unclear exactly, you know, the benefits. Mr. Karzai has, as I said, you know, carries a lot of weight in the South. And,
we'll see what he can pull out.
And they say that they've been it's been a beneficial relationship.
And quite a close one. All right, Mark Mazzetti, New York Times national security correspondent, looking at the payroll there at the CIA. The brother of Hamid Karzai is apparently on it. He was one of the writers of the article reporting that relationship in the New York Times this morning. Coming up, the new documentary about Michael Jackson is making its worldwide debut today, and we'll hear from some voices of those who saw it and are continuing to see it later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee.
Kickoff is fielded at the 3-yard line by Chris Henry.
Oh, what a shot! The 22-yard line. A monster hit by Darrell Reed.
A monster hit. Those monster hits are the problem, supposedly. Congress is going to take a closer look at those monster hits and the possible concussions they cause among NFL players, how they may lead to brain damage. We're joined first by Dr. Anne McKee. She's Associate Professor of Neurology and Pathology and Director of Boston University's Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
You has actually studied the brains of several former NFL players. And quickly, without, you know, confusing me, how do we know this is an injury to the brain that's caused by these hits they're taking on the football field?
Well, the brains of all of these players have had a disease called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a disease characterized by this buildup of tau protein in the form of neurofibrillary tangles that actually form inside the nerve cells of the brain. This disorder is only seen after trauma. It's been seen in boxers since the 1950s, and now we're seeing it in professional football players.
The NFL very often is denying that there's a connection, and they're saying this could be caused by other things going on. In your mind, is there any doubt that for these football players, the brain damage is caused by their athletics?
I've been looking at brains for 23 years, looking at brains from individuals from all walks of life, individuals of all ages, people up to 115. I've never seen these changes in brains except individuals that have suffered repetitive head trauma.
Okay. Dr. Anne McKee is Associate Professor of Neurology and Pathology, Director of Boston University's Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy. We're now joined by Alan Schwartz. He's a New York Times reporter who's been covering this issue for a while. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Alan, these hearings in Congress are meant to address these injuries and possibly hold the NFL liable for the injuries to the players?
Oh, good grief, no. This isn't about liability. This is about getting the right facts about what roles football has played in the injuries that are being found in these players, including the post-mortem diagnoses of chronic traumatic encephalopathy that Dr. McKee and her colleagues have been at the forefront of, but also the levels of dementia and cognitive impairment and depression and substance abuse that also can be attributed to incipient stages of the disease that Dr. McKee has been finding. It's a question of what role did football play?
Right,
virtually every doctor who has studied the issue believes that football plays at least a significant, if not astronomical, role. The NFL claims there is no reliable evidence to suggest that football plays any role.
Right,
this is where the conflict lies.
But Alan, they've been trying to get boxing banned for 50 years because we see the same kind of injuries in 15% of boxers. If they're going to study this and say, yes, football causes this, what's the next step?
Well, that's not for me to say. That's for Congress. I mean, you get John Conyers on the phone. But I think that comparing football to boxing is a leap that we probably don't need to make right now. I think the only step that should be taken, it would seem to me, would be to get Dr. McKee and her colleagues and the other people who have been researching this issue to get their full day in front of hopefully a reasonable congressional panel, mm-hmm. who can then compare the statements made by them and whatever incentives they may have, compare those
right.
with the statements made by the NFL and their doctors,
okay.
and whatever incentives they may have.
Alan Schwartz is a New York Times reporter who's been covering this story.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up,
this is it. Here I stand.
A new documentary about Michael Jackson hits theaters worldwide today. We're going to hear about what the first few audiences had to say about the film in just a few moments. But we're also hearing stories about you and your job and your profession and the economy and how you're adapting to the changing economy. Have you retrained or do you want to retrain to make your resume better fit where you think the economy is going? Let us know your retraining story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. A huge car bomb has exploded in northwest Pakistan in the city of Peshawar, killing at least 91 people, most of them women and children. At least 200 others were injured. Mark Dummett, correspondent for our partner, the BBC, reports from Islamabad.
The massive car bomb tore through the crowds at the busy marketplace in the middle of the morning. Most of the victims were women and children. Many shops and buildings were destroyed in the blast and the fire which followed. Rescuers pulled corpses and survivors from the wreckage. It was like an earthquake, one shopkeeper said. The attack came as the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in the capital Islamabad, pledging support for the Pakistan government's struggle against the militants. This has been an especially bloody month, and Peshawar, the main city in the embattled northwest, has been especially badly hit. The Taliban have denied being behind this bombing, but the government blames them for a wave of attacks, apparently launched in response to a major army operation against their strongholds on the Afghan border.
That's Mark Dummett, Islamabad correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Meanwhile, in neighboring Afghanistan, the United Nations says six of its staff were killed when gunmen stormed a guest house in Kabul. The Associated Press says at least one of the dead is an American. And staying in Afghanistan, our partner, the New York Times, is reporting this morning that the brother of Afghan President Hamid Karzai is on the CIA payroll, and that he has been since the war there began. Ahmed Wali Karzai denied receiving payments.
Here in the U.S., the financial arm of General Motors, GMAC, says it needs billions of dollars more in government bailout funds. The government has injected $12.5 billion into the company already and owns about a third of it. Factory orders for big-ticket manufactured goods went up 1% last month. That's the biggest jump in the past year and a half. Keep an eye out now for new home sales from last month. They'll be out in about 10 minutes. NASA has once again postponed the launch of its newest rocket until later this morning, about 45 minutes from now. Yeah, right. subject to change depending on the weather. Poor NASA. New study shows that an extract of the spice turmeric, which is often used in yellow curry, can help kill off cancer cells. Researchers in Cork, Ireland, found that malignant cells began to die within 24 hours of being exposed to the extract. And looking ahead to later tonight, weather permitting again, we have to say it because it's a nasty day in New York, the New York Yankees host the Philadelphia Phillies in Game 1 of the World Series. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
I would imagine most people recognize that particular drums and bass. That's from Billie Jean by Michael Jackson. Before his death, Michael Jackson was in rehearsal for his supposedly last concert tour. It was supposed to be his swan song.
These will be my final show performances in London. This will be it. This is it. And when I say this is it, it really means this is it. This is the final curtain call. I'll see you in July.
Obviously, Michael Jackson did not make those appearances, but we get a peek into the rehearsals from them from this documentary that premieres in theaters worldwide this morning called This Is It. We're joined now by Chris Hawkins. He's a presenter on BBC Six Music. Chris joins us from inside the Central London Movie Theater. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, and yes, despite the hype on this, it's a very mild but overcast day here in London. I expected to be in this theatre overrun with fans, but there are really only a handful of people queuing for the next screening, which is at midday our time.
Really? How many is a handful?
When I say a handful, I would say a dozen or two dozen at the most. The first screening at the Central London Theatre that I'm at was at 4 a.m., and I've just checked, there were four people at that screening. So I'm absolutely amazed. I don't think that's the same for the whole of London, but certainly, and I am right bang in the middle of London, that's the situation, and I'm really, really shocked.
But we do have some extremely persistent fans. We're joined now by Yvonne Holland as well. She's a huge Michael Jackson fan who went to see the movie. And Yvonne, you went to a three-day slumber party in order to pick up your tickets, correct?
Yes, I did.
She joins us from Los Angeles, California. What was the urgency to be among the first to see this movie?
Because everything that Michael Jackson does is top-notch. He talks often about what he wants to give to the fans. And so he is really in there to make us love him.
Yvonne, Michael is no longer with us, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's a disappointment, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I mean, he lets you down there. It would have been better to see the concert than this film, right?
Well, I mean, nobody wants somebody to die, especially the way he did.
Chris, going back to you in London, have there been protests from fans at the premiere of this movie?
For the most part, it went very smoothly. The premiere took place at 1 o'clock London time in Leicester Square, and there were real diehard fans there, fans that are hugely passionate, like Yvonne, about Michael Jackson and all that he achieved in his, I guess, relatively short life. But as I say, here now in central London, it's very subdued. There are more people queuing for Fantastic Mr. Fox than there are This Is It, which I'm told will book up later in the day. I'm told that this evening's performances and showings are actually nearly full. But whether over the course of the next 2 weeks that will remain the case, I really, really don't know. And I would be inclined to say that this will tail off rather than be an extended run, which was rumoured, because we are now what would have been halfway through the series of concerts at the O2 in London.
Yvonne, back to you in Los Angeles. Can you tell us a little bit about the movie? Do you get a sense of continuity through the movie? Do we get any sense of what the full concert would have looked like?
You know what? It would have been so worth it. He did a lot of filming to make certain songs even more enhanced, and he was going to incorporate that with his live singing. And I have a lot of his DVDs, and this was just so outstanding. If they would have incorporated that in his concert, his fans, no matter how much money they paid, they would have been getting their money's worth. And they show all of this inside the movie, too.
Yvonne, I have to ask you, fans have been protesting, asking people not to go because they feel like the film hides the fact that Michael Jackson was actually in deteriorating health, and these were his last moments as his health was failing. And does it bother you to watch this film and not see this man struggling?
I don't see him struggling at all.
Right, but they're supposedly excerpted the parts so that you don't see him struggling.
Well, that's because that's the way Michael Jackson is. He always wants to give his fans top-notch performances, and that's him. That's how it is.
That's how he was.
Yes. Well, that's how he was, and that's how it is.
Well, Yvonne, I mean, the movie does permit a kind of fantasy of being in the show, almost as though you're part of the dance troupe. I'd never seen video of Michael Jackson being a director and a choreographer. You know, that seems like some of the most exciting stuff to watch.
Yes, he did everything, but he also had a choreographer, and he also had another director, and so they had a sense of what he wanted, and so they, you know, made it happen that way. But he was also there saying if he wanted it changed, if he wanted the music to be held on longer, if he wanted the dance to be a certain way. It was awesome to see the behind-the-scenes kind of thing.
Yvonne, was this more of a concert performance thing that you were watching, or was
absolutely.
It more of a documentary?
It was not a documentary. It was like if you've seen the DVD Bucharest Live, it was like that.
It's That's like Yvonne Bucharest Live.
Holland.
Have you seen Bucharest Live?
I know.
Learning about it.
Yvonne Holland in
morning.
Los Angeles went to see This Is It, the Michael Jackson concert documentary that premieres worldwide today. She also went to a 3-day slumber party in order to get her tickets. We are also joined by Chris Hawkins, a host on BBC Six Music and a Michael Jackson fan.
I mean, that was some blissed out Yvonne there. It was nice to talk
to her. Absolutely.
This Is It, the end of the hour. Before we go, we still want to hear from you. We've been hearing stories of how your job and your profession are changing because of the economy. Tell us, have you been training or retraining for the changing economy? Are you using this transitional time to change your profession completely? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
American companies have outsourced. They're chasing lower labor rates, and what they're missing is the ingenuity and the hard work ethic of Americans.
That's our friend Mickey Maynard. She doesn't miss anything. She's the author of the new book, The Selling of the American Economy. Go listen to her interview. You can find it on our podcast to go. You can subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
Bucharest Live. I'm Googling that right now. Nothing's coming up. Bucharest Live.
It must be a Michael Jackson concert.
Yeah, it is.
I assume.
Bucharest Live. Have you seen Bucharest Live, Matt?
I have not.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
The Takeaway.
It is. This Is It.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.